You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic.
I'm Cameron Lalana.
And I'm Matt Garasimovich.
And today we're covering part two, chapter 30 of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate, continuing along with Eichmann's visit to the death camp. Eichmann, whose presence is so chilling that we start to see the kind of deleterious effects that this work and Eichmann's presence has had on him. Is there anywhere in particular that you'd like to start with this part?
Yeah, so it's clearly a big event for him to come and visit, and it seems like everybody has sort of picked up on that. And it is one of the more sinister chapters, for sure, I would say, and Grossman kind of sets that tone immediately with the tour that Eichmann and Liss are embarking on, and says a small surprise had been laid for them, which in the middle of the gas chambers, the engineers had laid a small table with hors d'oeuvres and wine, and they sit down and they toast and they are having this conversation on how many Jews are to be executed in these chambers. And even Liss is kind of amazed when the response he gets is millions. And so it is the kind of, well, I don't know about exactly the next few chapters, but this one to me kind of felt like the culmination of the last two or three chapters, where it's been very, 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 I would say very quiet in some ways. Everything has been unspoken, or many things have been unspoken, unsaid, and so this is kind of that culmination.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, like you say, this is, I mean, just such an incredibly tense chapter. I think it kind of goes to, in my mind, a climax when they're eating sandwiches in the gas chamber, and the narrator tells us the tension in this concrete silence in these full glasses was so extreme that Liss felt his heart was about to burst. What he wanted was some ringing toast to clear the atmosphere, a toast to the glory of the German ideal. Instead, the tension grew stronger. Eichmann was chewing a sandwich. And that's something that's really interesting to me in this chapter, is I feel there's a very palpably different way in which Eichmann and Liss are portrayed. In that we do see Liss kind of as categorization of leadership. And then presumably Liss would be among the second kind of those of the cynics, right? But there are the bloody-minded dogmatists who really believe everything that the party says, hook, line, and sinker. They are the most up-to-date on films, on plays, on whatever, and how well or how poorly it represents, you know, the national culture created by fascism. And these types, typically, as Liss notes in his characterization, tend to be more rank and file or low level leadership, but there are times like now, like with Eichmann, where they are elevated. And this is a theme that I think you can tie back to Grossman's other work. So in The Hell of Treblinka, Grossman addresses the creatures who he calls them creatures, the people who he says should be studied in institutions. And the thing about fascism is that they elevate such types into positions of power in tens and hundreds of prisons and penal colonies and death camps. And I think this is expanded on a little bit here with Liss kind of talking about these categories or four categories of leader, and among one of which is the bloody mindedness like Eichmann. So this isn't just this, what they're doing isn't a trivial matter. And most of them know it's not a trivial matter, but there are those who are just either dumb enough or just lack the creativity to understand the horror of what they're doing, like Eichmann, who are elevated at times like this. And Liss notes, quite rightly, tend to be disposed of once that the need for them is no longer there. They're not particularly useful outside of such bloody work.
Yeah, there's an interesting conversation to be had about the way that he perceives the different categories of people in this hierarchy, and then that relationship to what it looks like maybe comparably on the Soviet side, because for this third category of men, as he dubs them, is these are the leaders, the type that he really aspires to. And he says that here were no dogmas, here everything could be discussed freely. And this sort of reminds me of that situation that we see on the Soviet side during the evacuation, where there is that almost kernel, a little kernel of freedom, where everything, kind of, not quite everything, but a lot of things can be discussed at least more freely than normal. And I think that this is kind of antithetical to the National Socialist state as he sets up in the previous paragraphs, where everything has to be directed. There is no organic life that is developing. Whereas I think that Grossman sees, at least, though maybe not the most redeeming quality, a little bit of organic life from the Soviet side.
Yeah, we've touched on it again, but I think it does bear repeating, especially in a novel that does do so much comparison work between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. It's worth paying attention to the nuances that Grossman engages with or even cuts out in these depictions, in the way that there is great horror at the fascist movements in Germany. And it's great horror at its own, at the very matter of fascism itself, whereas the horror, I think, in the Soviet Union is much more the horror of how tragically the Soviet project has gone from Grossman's perspective and what it does to the people in that system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. But that's about all I wanted to cover for today.
Yeah, I think that's where we're going to leave it this evening. So that means you will be hearing from us again soon.